September 7th, 1980, at the family home in Placentia. Dad, we know you were born in Davenport, Iowa in 1922 and later moved to Santa Monica, California. Tell us about your childhood growing up in Davenport and then your move to California.
Well, I don't remember much about my life in Davenport except that I remember that we lived on Lombard Street as I was getting to the age of going to school. I do remember that I was enrolled at St. Paul's School with the thought in mind that I would be going to kindergarten. But instead of that, I was in the first grade. Therefore, I started the school when I was 5 instead of 6, and I was always, as a result of that, I was always the youngest kid in the class. I went to St. Paul's for 2 years, then we moved down to Bridge Avenue, and when we moved down there, well, I went to Sacred Heart School, grade school. Spent the rest of my grade school years there. As a part of being in that school and being that school being associated with the cathedral in town, all of the boys were altar boys, and so I spent much of my Sundays as being an altar boy. After Sacred Heart School, I went to St. Ambrose Academy. Started there as a freshman in 1935. Only went there for about 2 months. When the decision was made that we were going to move to California. So it was my dad, mother, grandfather, and little brother that traveled to California. We drove out, settled in Venice. The reason why we came to California was that my dad had been seriously ill. And we came out here for him to try to get his health back. As I say, we lived in Venice. The decision was made for me to go to a Catholic high school out here, which was called Mount Carmel. The reason why I went to Mount Carmel as opposed to Loyola was because Bill still had a year left of high school. He had come out here the summer before. He had still had a year left of high school. No particular reason, but we decided that we weren't going to go to the same school together.
You boys decided that?
Well, it was, this other school was a pretty nice school, and it was a brand new school. And it was in the southwest part of town where my grandmother lived. And so I decided that maybe I'd go there instead of going to Loyola. And that was fine. Everybody was agreeable with that. So I did live with my grandmother and went to high school. Bill lived there also and went to Loyola. But I continued on with that school. As I say, it was a brand new one. And it was just the second year in existence when I went there. And it was built on the premise that it would be a progressive kind of a school as the kids moved from grade to grade, well, the school would increase. So in my first year, there was just a sophomore and a freshman year, and then sophomore, freshman, junior, etc., etc., until, so as a result of that, I was in the second graduating class of that school in 1939.
You mentioned at one time that you worked your way through to pay.
Well, as I say, I stayed in Los Angeles most of the time during the week going to school. And then I would go on the weekends, I would come down to the beach, down to Venice, and eventually Ocean Park as we moved around. And so as a part of that, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was my sophomore year or my junior year. I don't really remember. But anyhow, I did get a job on a pier. So I did have a bit of income And so I did use my money for my tuition. Tuition wasn't very much in those days. I think it was something like $4 or $5 a month or something like that to go to school, and that's all it cost. So I put it, I used my money to pay my tuition, buy my books, and this and that and the other thing, my transportation back and forth to the beach. And as I went further in school, I decided that I would live at home as opposed to living at my grandmother's. And so I had to take care of my transportation, and or there were times when there were some of us that lived in at the beach and did go to Mount Carmel. So either I had transportation with one of the fellow's dads, or we hitchhiked, or we rode the red cars. And in our last year, well, one of the kids had a car, so we all used that as a means to get to school. And of course, we paid him for his gasoline, isn't that the other thing? And as I say, either I worked on weekends and during the summer, and of course, holidays and all this kind of thing. So it was a case of where when everybody else was off, well, we were working, because on the piers, well, you know, those were the big days for the holidays. And so we worked long hours working there when everybody else was out enjoying themselves.
What kind of a job?
Well, we had what we called a court baseball thing, and it was a batting cage is what it was. Our jobs were to collect the money, of course, let the people in and do their batting, and to keep score with respect to how they hit the ball as to what kind of scores they made. Isn't that kind of like a, we kept score kind of like a bowling line. Added it up as you went across. They got 4 points for a home run, 3 points for a triple, 2 for a double, and 1 for a single. Strikes didn't count against them, of course. They had 9 hits at the ball. Cost a nickel. Nickel for 9 hits. And I think the way things worked, I think we got a penny a line. I think that's what it was. So for every nickel, we made a penny.
Hmm. What kind of things did you and the family do for social type things?
Oh, I don't know that there was anything much social. Of course, part of that time, particularly in the later years, well, Dad wasn't here. Dad was back in Davenport, still working at the store, and at that time building his boat. And so there wasn't much in the way of a social thing, because actually, as I say, it's particularly the weekend kind of a thing. And the summer times were spent working. Didn't do much work during the daytime, because the pier was basically open in the afternoons and evenings. So the result of that is I spent a lot of time at the beach during the daytime, just laying on the sand, swimming, surfing, this and the other thing. Went to a lot of movies, I guess. It's like a lot of other people did.
In 1937, Grandpa and your older brother Bill set out on a round-the-world trip in a 38-foot catch named the Exchange. Grandpa built that in Davenport. Can you tell me what you remember about that voyage?
Well, yeah, I remember that when Dad finally did build the boat, and of course he was writing to us and telling us about how things were progressing and this and the other thing. By the time it got built, ready to be launched, I do remember his writing about it, and of course also articles in the paper from back there about trying to get it down from Uncle Harold's house down to the river. It's a pretty heavy boat, and they used house moving equipment to get it moved. Lawrence Avenue. They moved it on down to the river. Of course, there's a seawall down there that they had to lift it up over. And it took them several days to get the job done because it was so heavy. And they did move it like, as I say, like a house. And they finally launched it. And then Dad and Uncle Harold and Mac McDermott took the boat on down the river, got it down to New Orleans, Biloxi. And by that time it was running on towards Christmas holiday season. Dad came out to spend the holidays with us and decided that he was going to take Bill back with him to go on this trip that he wanted to go on. Needless to say, I was a little bent out of shape because I couldn't go, but I did have my final year of high school, so I wasn't allowed to go. They went back there and put the rigging up at that point in time. They went down the river with a mast just laying on the deck. When they got down there, well, they outfitted and put the mast up, put the rigging up, had the sails made. Then they took off on their what was intended to be a voyage around the world. They went to, let's see, I think it was Easter Sunday was the day they took off. They went to Florida, spent some time in Florida, left Florida, went to Cuba. From Cuba they went to Jamaica. They went to Panama Canal. And all the time, of course, we were getting letters from them as to how their voyage was going and this and that and the other thing. The things they ran into. How they were pretty much enjoying the sea, enjoying the trip. I guess when they got to, after they got through the canal and onto the other side, the Atlantic, on the Pacific side, there was some thought about maybe they'd abandon the voyage and have the boat shipped up. And they decided they would not do that. One of cost is one of the reasons. They wouldn't do that and they would sail on up. So their intention was that when they left the canal, they would go either west or more likely even southwest. Sail that way and then tack back and come back. Instead of when they left the coast, when they left the canal, they had a pretty good breeze, which took them straight northwest. And so they took that and went northwest until they hit the doldrums. Took them up and dropped them right in there without any breeze or anything else. So there were many, many days that they were out there, and had intended that it would probably take them maybe about upwards of about 90 days to get here, and somewhere between 60 and 90. And instead, of course, it took them a lot longer than that. I was still, as I say, I was still working on the pier at the time, and when it came time for me to think that they ought to be here, I'd always go out the end of the pier and see if I could see them sailing up into Santa Monica. Of course, I didn't even know what the boat was going to look like or anything else at that point. But anyhow, nothing happened. They didn't show up. We became a little bit worried about the time that we hadn't heard from them or anything, and so contacted the Ghost Guard and see if they couldn't go out and find them or what have you. And as far as we were concerned, they were lost. As it came out, as it turned out, they weren't lost. They knew where they were all the time, but they couldn't do anything about it. But anyhow, the Coast Guard never did find them. So they found themselves and got themselves up to San Pedro. We finally got a letter that Dad had written and given to a fisherman on what was known then as Guadalupe Island off the coast of Mexico. The fisherman was out of Newport, I believe. So he brought the letter, and they had addressed it to Aunt Mary, who worked at Young's Market Company. And they felt that they could probably get it, be more apt to have that letter delivered to her than it would be to us, because didn't know whether we still lived in the same place or not. The day we got the letter, we were pretty apt guys that came off that boat that were, they had a story about, pictures about in the newspaper. Yeah, I guess maybe we do look something like them. Anyhow, that's that. That's about what I remember as far as my thoughts about what they were doing on their trip when we finally got here. And the boat was pretty well beat up. Needed a lot of work on it, so we headed down to San Pedro. And we did get down there and do some work on it. Try to clean it up, fix it up, restore it, if you will. I do remember going down there one time. Bill and I went down and spent some time on it, a few days. And we painted the deck, painted the mast. I remember it was my job to paint the mast. So Bill had hauled me up there in what was a bosun's chair. It looks like a swing seat. Raise you up there, and you sit on the seat, paint the mast, and let yourself down a little bit at a time. I remember that Bill was painting the deck. It was kind of a light cream color that we were painting the deck. He was painting the deck kind of light cream color. And I was painting the mast, it was an orangish brown, I guess. Anyhow, I dropped a bucket of paint. It just went all over the place, all over him, all over the boat, all over the deck. Start over again. We used the boat a little bit out of San Pedro, did some sailing. Of course, it took a long time to get out of the channels down there and out in the sea. So we made a decision that we'd bring it up to Santa Monica and put it behind the breakwater in Santa Monica. Dad lived on it for a while, spent most of his time on the boat, and I'd go down on the weekends if I wasn't working and stay with him, and we'd go out sailing once in a while. And Bill and I took it out for a couple of trips with some guys off the pier. And by and large, we didn't use it that much. Then ultimately, as far as, well, we gave up on the pier. I went to work for a guy that had come out here from Davenport and started a restaurant and a hotel. And I went to work for him, washing dishes, $10 a week. And that lasted for a while. And then Dad also got involved with it was a friend of Bill's. His dad was phonograph business, phonographs and bars and what have you, Nickelodeons, where you put a nickel in and get a record. Got involved in that, and they decided that they were going to set up this thing where they were going to have a central site where the record players were, and you made your request by microphone. You requested the piece of music or a record, and then was set on a central turntable and piped over to the bar or the restaurant, wherever you're talking about. So anyhow, I went to work for them, and this was in Hollywood. Went to work for them. We built, I don't know, 3 or 4 units or something like that. And then that kind of petered out. I guess maybe that was before was, as I say, working for Douglas as the war was progressing. And I suppose just like everybody else in those days, of course the draft had started, that was one of the things, but there were just an awful lot of people, a lot of young fellows that decided that they should enlist and go to war. And of course, I guess we were, both Bill and I felt the same way about the thing. He ultimately enlisted in the Navy, which was one of those things that he wanted to go to the Navy. Tried several times to get in, kept failing all the time because he was colorblind, and he couldn't read the color charts. So I know that I somehow or other, and I can't remember how this was, but he managed to check one of these color books out of the library, and he brought it home, and I'd sit there with him, and we would go over the thing. Finally got to the point where he memorized the pages. He'd see a word, you know, they were numbers and dots. And he'd see numbers there that, as far as I was concerned, weren't there, and then there were numbers that he couldn't see at all. So it was the way the thing was set up. Anyhow, he finally memorized all that stuff and went down again. I think the recruiting office was in the post office in Santa Monica. So he went down again, passed the test, and the next thing I knew, he came home and said he was in the Navy. So that left me alone. Of course, Bob was pretty young at that time. So anyhow, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I didn't want to join the Navy. And then I thought some of maybe joining the Merchant Marine. So I wrote for that kind of stuff. It was kind of an enlistment kind of a thing. It wasn't military. And but you'd be on freighters and tankers and things like that. That's what you'd be doing. And ultimately, what they call liberty ships. So I came pretty close to enlisting in that. I thought, no, I didn't want to do that. So I finally enlisted in the Air Force. Well, it was the Army Air Corps, what they called it at that time. Part of the Army. And you had to enlist that way. Of course, all the time I was underage. I had to get consent to do this. So the mother signed the papers, and I enlisted in the Army Air Corps, and I was going to be a cadet, hotshot pilot. The only thing about enlisting at that time was that their backlogs were pretty good, so it looked like after I enlisted, probably about 6 months before I was even called into active service. So I continued to work at Douglas. There was another fellow out there that enlisted about the same time I had in the Air Corps. And so we were just keeping track of each other and finding out what we were hearing from the Army and what have you. And finally he got his call. And I knew mine was coming up pretty close, so I know that the one night that we decided that we were going to turned in our resignation to Douglas because we're going to be called up. We went up to the supervisor who was running our department at that time, told him that we were, I don't know, I guess we gave him a week's notice or something like that, that we were going to be leaving in a week. I remember he was pretty much bent out of shape at that time, that with the two of us leaving, that left the department 51% women working in the department and only 49% guys. He was kind of unhappy with that. Yeah, that's the way things turned out as far as the aircraft industry is concerned, anyhow, because the women took over and took the place of the guys that were leaving to be either enlisting or being drafted or what have you. So, be that as it may, nothing at the time. Just waiting for my call. I stayed home. I know that, well, my eyes were bad too. I need to have them strengthened, particularly because I'd spent so much time working graveyard shift that my eyes were in bad shape. And they always were anyhow. I had to wear glasses. So anyhow, I went through some series of exercise with the doctor and tried to get my eyes straightened out. I also remember I had all the fillings replaced in my teeth. Went to some young dentist that was just out of, I guess he was out of SC, I don't know. Anyhow, I went to him. It was his decision I should have all my fillings replaced, because if I was going to be in the Air Force and flying at altitude, probably those old fillings had to be revamped so that they'd be better. Anyhow, I went through that. That was a miserable thing because he didn't use Novocaine or anything. He just ground them all out and replaced them all. I had that all done. So eventually I did get my notice that I was going to go into active service. And, I think it was in January. I'm not real sure. But anyhow, I had to report for service. And I had to report in Santa Ana. That was where the cadet school was. So I went down there, going through all the different things, and passing the physical and this and that and the other thing. And of course, I failed on my eyes. I couldn't see those darn things when they project them on the wall. I just couldn't see them unless it was a dark, real dark room. And anyhow, I couldn't read those letters from any distance. You know what I'm talking about. It's the same kind of thing that the eye doctor uses, where he projects those things through that's a film kind of thing he projects. I couldn't see those things for sour apples. So anyhow, I knew I was going to fail that. Well, that was all right. At that time, they were kind of desperate, and they, as far as the crew was concerned, on an aircraft, they said, no, you can't be a pilot, but you could be a navigator or a bombardier, and I'm flying. So I had to sign waivers to say that I would not be able to be a pilot, but I could go ahead through with the training and become either a navigator or a bombardier, so that was fine. And then as things went along, and you finally had to go up for a hearing, and they decided that no, that I couldn't be a cadet, I guess most of it was that I was with the nervous type and therefore couldn't make it. So I was washed out of cadet training. And you go before a board and they talk to you about, what do you think about this? Do you want to appeal your case or anything? Well, there's no sense in trying to appeal the case. It was a cut and dry thing. So I said, okay. The only question I asked was, is there a possibility that I become a part of the air crew at all? No, you can't, because your eyes aren't good enough. Part of the air crew being, of course, you're either going to be a radio operator.